Welcome to the Kadampa Center. So we always do the infamous, and everyone else will do it, but who's new tonight? Good. newish. Who's new? I didn't say new to what, did I? Just said who's new. So presenting the path. I don't have any humor for that one. I usually have something goofy to say, but it's pretty straightforward, presenting the path. So you've got a great teacher in Don. Lots of classes from him. He's awesome. So I just want to say welcome all in, coming in here at the beginning of each module. I'm Jill, the center manager, just to say hello and welcome you and give you another face to the center. Everything we do here, you've all heard the spiel a lot, but it's good to remind yourselves that everything we do here is by donation only. And to get a little perspective, the other centers around the country and around the world charge for these classes. So one of our members traveled around and he was just like, they want $12 from me. Or something, $25 per class or something, and then like each module might be $120. So we like to kid about thinking about the price of therapy or the price of, that's better in some of the transforming problems, that fits better in that one. But if you feel like donating, there's a way to give by text giving, which is new, kind of fun and sexy. So that's on the back of the wall. And then online giving onto realm.org, on realm.org. And then the two boxes outside. And so checks, cash, anything, love notes, we take it all. What else? So all the other classes we have, Meditation 101 just started, and Buddhism in a Nutshell, and they're going to roll each year. Just so you know, we have actually, I think maybe, I'm not sure, for the first time ever, the entire calendar for the year is populated with all the DB classes. Yeah, that's pretty exciting. That took some time to do. So if they're all in there, I hope they're all right, the practice days and everything, so you can plan your year out a little bit for those of you who are going to keep on keeping on. So the materials are up on the webpage. There's no restrictions to the website. Erin talks about all that. Everything should be good to go. Anything else, Erin? You've got the tech part. Thanks, guys. Have fun.
Okay, so this is module 3 since we started going through Discovering Buddhism again. We've been doing this since 2003, going through all the modules and going through all the modules. So just keep coming. Come back whenever you can and get through them all at some point. From module 1, our leftover business is that I have some signed certificates and completion cards in this green folder. So if you still need to pick yours up, it's going to be in the back. For module 2, I have a big empty folder for anyone who still needs to turn in their completion card and their essay, which is why most of us did not meet the first deadline.
Do you have a question?
Yeah. So if it's a new year, let's try to get them in by next week. We said first class of this module, so we'll go with second class of this module, which is a week from today. We can all get those second module completion cards in by next week, I think. We'll be excited, ready to go, right? And I will pass them along to Shanka, who will then return them. Now we're on module 3. There's a handout in the back pertaining to module 3, which is like stuff you need to know, like how do you get the readings, how do you get the books, some prayers, and I even did graphics this time because people still can't find stuff on the website, so hopefully that will help. A segment about watching the class online if you need to stream from home one night or if you need to listen to a recording because you didn't make it. Our awesome media team makes that possible. Because of that, we also need to always talk into a microphone when we're asking a question or answering a question so that people that are streaming can hear what's going on or they're listening to a recording, they can follow along by hearing your questions. The completion card is separate from the how to do everything. I decided to do that because, you know, maybe 20, maybe 30 of you will do a completion card, but not everybody. This has all the readings on it, everything you need to know. And then if you're going to kind of complete the completion card as you're going, keep track of everything, want to turn it in, great. You'll grab a completion card and fill it in as you go. But if not, that's great, too. Learn what you can. Any questions? Logistics. I'm Erin. I should be here for all of the modules. You have a different wonderful teacher for each of the different modules. Well, they start repeating, but That teacher's not always the same, but I should always be the same. Hopefully I can keep up and answer your questions. Thank you all very much for returning. It's good to see everybody again.
I did. There it goes. Hey, testing. All right, good. Put it in my pocket. The one I don't have. Oh, well. We'll figure this out. Okay. So let's start out the... We're going to watch a video tonight, a little bit of free... Tonight's pretty free form because, you know, we've got... first of all, I should introduce myself, shouldn't I? And then we'll watch a video. I'll throw a lot of information out. And then we'll do some a little bit of meditation toward the end again. And then maybe between now and then I'll decide what kind of homework I think might be useful. But this class is like meant to be an overview of all of Buddhism. Can you imagine in 6 hour-and-a-half classes? We lost one class last week to the bad weather, right? So the simple way to put this is that the teachings of the Buddha are vast. I mean, just amazing, thousands of pages. But they really got distilled by Lama Tsongkhapa and Lama Atisha, some great Tibetan. Well, Atisha was an Indian, Lama Tsongkhapa was a Tibetan. But they got distilled in a way that, you know, we can sort of wrap our mind around it. And so this is what this class is about, is to give us the essence, the key things that we need to understand to get the big picture. Then everything that happens in discovering Buddhism and everything that happens at Kadampa Center can be plugged into these teachings that we're going to go into over the next 6 weeks. So my name is Don Brown, and I first started practicing Buddhism in 19... Well, first I was introduced to Buddhism in Kathmandu to Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa, who are behind here, in 1978, and I've been involved, you know, with Kadampa Center since the very beginning, and I've taught this class several times. I love this class, and I teach different. I think I teach 2 modules a year of discovering Buddhism. So you'll see me again. That might not be a good thing, but I will teach again a couple of other ones. One that I always end up teaching because nobody else wants to teach it is Introduction to Tantra. But anyway, and so let's start out with a little meditation and calm down, and I'll do a little motivation because that's what gets me into the mood to be here. Maybe we can hit the light switch in the back, take out some of the bright lights in the back of the room. Yeah, that's good. And so sit up straight now that all of you have been meditating. And if you have cell phones and or whatever, you might want to silence those. Bring your awareness to your breath and follow your breath. You can count, you know, count to 10, out and in 1, out and in 2, like that. Or you can count out 1, in 2, but just count up to 10 and then start over again. But the point is to bring your mind to move away from the discursive, chattering mind and focus on something, in this case, the breath and the counting of the breath. When we study about karma, not much has been said about it. We'll talk about it tonight, and there's a whole module on karma. But the key factor in the power of a particular action, be it positive or positive actions are the ones that lead to happiness, or negative, the actions lead to suffering. The key determinant is one's motivation. So, you know, we could have many motivations. You might want to really put some thought into why you're here. What is it that you want to accomplish? What's the result that you'd like to have in your life, particularly from a spiritual perspective? A month, a year down the road. 5 years down the road, what would you like to have happen as a result of your participation in discovering Buddhism? And one of the motivations that we could have would be just to, you know, for our own personal happiness right now, this lifetime, today, which is a positive motivation. It might not be considered to be dharma, and we'll talk about that word later on, but it's a positive motivation that you want to be happier, you want to be calmer, you want to be a better parent, a better partner, just a kinder person, all of those things. Those are great intentions, motives for practice. You know, on a bigger scale, we might have the motivation to practice so we could achieve, like, a better next life. You know, I think in Christianity, for example, you know, that's the motivation. I was raised Presbyterian, and our, you know, that was the goal was to have a, you know, the next life to be a good life, to be in heaven. Like that. So that could be some people's motivation for practice. Another motivation, which is a little bit more powerful, motivation for our mind would be to achieve what's called nirvana, liberation, which is this is something that Buddhism posits that is pretty outrageous when you think about it. There's a claim that we can be totally free of suffering. Not that sickness, old age, and death are going to stop. They're going to happen one way or the other. But we do not have to suffer. That is something that's controlled by our mind. And if we train our mind properly, we do not have to suffer. We can be completely free. That's called liberation, nirvana. And that's a very powerful motivation to have for spiritual practice, is to achieve complete liberation from suffering. But then if you're looking for rocket fuel for your practice, which I know we all are, the rocket fuel for spiritual practice that really empowers everything that we do is to do it for others, which is completely antithetical to our usual self-centered attitude. We instinctively think that we are the most important one. We're the universe really does revolve around me and you. We all have that thought. And that's just how how we're wired. This self-centered attitude is in Buddhism what we call ignorance. This selfish, self-centered mind is the cause of all of our problems. And the amazing antidote to that is focusing on others. Even our spiritual evolution, our spiritual practice, like, may I achieve my highest potential as a living being, may I achieve full enlightenment, as complete cessation of my confusion and development of all of my good qualities, compassion, loving kindness, wisdom, skillful means, those things. May I develop all of those good qualities and eliminate all my faults and be a perfect guide for others. And I dedicate my spiritual practice to that end. May I become enlightened in order to benefit others. So the shift is away from self and self-centeredness and toward others. So this is not a natural instinct, but it's something that we, at least in the beginning, can effortfully do, and then over time the mind is always changing, right? Always changing moment to moment. It can be trained through the force of familiarity. We can shift the focus away from our self-centered selfishness toward others as much as possible. Let's set our motivation for being here tonight and really for the next 6 weeks with this motivation of practicing, developing our mind in order to benefit others. And others are not some we think of others as being like singular, but it's actually infinite beings. And it's the people we live with. It's your family, it's your children, it's your coworkers, it's our community. Those are the people that, we really want to be able to impact the most, in the beginning at least. So try to set that motivation. We're going to watch our video now, and this is going to make my job easy because I don't have to do much tonight, because they're going to cover the three principles of the path, the whole path, and start out with the life of the Buddha, Venerable George Chernoff, and then different teachers. Many of these teachers have taught here at Kadampa Center over the years, so just relax and enjoy.
Shows us how to transform our minds from a state of suffering and dissatisfaction to one of extraordinary joy, awareness, and contentment. Vast in scope and profound in its implications, Buddhism accommodates every kind of mental disposition, but retains a laser-like precision that shows us what is to be accepted and what is to be rejected. It is realized and embodied by a human being like us. 2,500 years ago, an Indian prince named Siddhartha from the Shakya clan decided to give up his kingdom to search for a way out of suffering. Because of his relentless determination to find ultimate freedom, he came to understand the nature of his mind and in turn the ultimate reality of all phenomena. He was then called Shakyamuni Buddha. In this show, we will learn about the historical Buddha's life story, spread of his teachings, and about the stages of the path to enlightenment.
In the following presentation, you're about to hear a great deal about the life, the accomplishments, and the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha. Now, the Buddha worked very hard in order to attain enlightenment. And the impetus behind that hard work was his strong motivation to achieve ultimate freedom and to benefit all living beings as much as possible. And so remembering that we've discussed in the past the importance of our own motivation and modeling after the historical Buddha himself, now, before receiving these teachings, set in your own mind a strong motivation to be able to traverse this spiritual path, to reach enlightenment as quickly as possible in order to benefit all living beings. Deeds are said to be
the same activities that all of the thousand Buddhas who will appear during this fortunate eon, this world system, will all engage in the same kinds of activities. They won't have exactly the same lives, they'll be born in different ways, but they'll have a certain format of their life that will be similar. And so for that reason, sort of, you might think it's just something that happened in the past, but it's going to happen in the future, so if you know about it, maybe you can be prepared when Maitreya comes and others. In the Mahayana scriptures, it said that the Buddha himself, the first deed is his leaving of Tushita, handing over the teachership of Tushita, the residency there, to Maitreya, who will be the next Buddha. And the second deed is entering into the womb. The Buddha entered into the womb of his future mother. And at that point she had this dream, very spectacular and pleasant dream, of a six-tusked white elephant entering into her. And upon exiting the womb, upon his birth, the Buddha was able to stand up. This young boy was able to stand up immediately and walk seven steps. The Buddha himself showed, Siddhartha himself, showed himself to be incredibly adroit and expert in many different things. And the next deed is called sporting or enjoying with the hari or retinue of wives. Every kind of pleasure, every kind of sense pleasure, food and warmth and various castles were built within the walls of the temple of the city, of the royal city, for the town. And it's during this point that he is now manifests kind of like what we might notice in the world when people get a little bit bored. He wants to go out of the temple as his first journey out. He did see some individuals, and on successive journeys, he saw at various times old people, sick people, and a dead person. And each time he would ask his attendants, what is this? I've never seen this before. What is this old person bent over and so forth, with a cane? What's wrong with him? And his attendant would say, this is an old person. This happened. And Siddhartha would say, is that unusual? Are there many of them? And he would say, this happens to everyone. Everyone. This is the fate of everyone. He saw someone who looked like a renunciate, someone who is seeking the meaning of life, seeking to transcend birth, death, and aging, death, sickness, and so forth, the things that the Buddha had perceived. So this gave the supposedly the elements now that began to coalesce, that clicked in the Siddhartha's mind. This is what I should do. I should leave home also. And he takes his hair, his beautiful royal locks, with his sword, cuts them off, and says that that's one of the relics. He goes off seeking teachers, seeking the answer to sickness and old age and death. And even though the teachers themselves were very fond of Siddhartha, recognized him as a prince, and saw his great qualities and the fact that he achieved their state, even though they were the teacher, he achieved the same realization they did in a very short amount of time. They asked him to stay on and teach their disciples. He refused and went off to try to find an answer to this riddle that he had encountered. Sometimes living on just a small berry from the tree a day, Siddhartha became very emaciated. So, at this point, the Buddha himself is beginning to recognize that he's not making any progress. The Buddha went to bathe in the river, so very weak, couldn't even get out of the water. Began to worry, what's going to happen. He began then to beg some food. Now the Buddha is invigorated, Siddhartha is invigorated, And he seeks now a place to do meditation, and then sits down on this cushion of grass with the determination, until I achieve the essence of enlightenment, I am not rising. So this is now the demarcation of the next act, which is called the defeat of Mara, or the defeat of the Maras. Mara is someone who it can be part of our own being, our own minds, or it can be something external that hinders our spiritual development. And that evening, he achieves his enlightenment, which is now called the next deed, under the Bodhi tree that evening, completely transformed, eliminating from his mind all the vestiges of ignorance and any kind of insufficiencies and abilities, and spends the next 7 weeks without moving very far away. Who shall I teach? Oh, those 5 disciples with whom I spent 6 years. Their minds are only, their Dharma eyes only slightly covered with the dust of ignorance. So he travels, knowing where they are, to the Deer Park near Sarnath. And he begins to teach them the very first discourse, the Four Noble Truths. And this is the beginning of this deed, which was essentially the next long period of the Buddha's life, many decades, teaching, and for the rest of his life at that time, after that time, spent many decades teaching, turning the wheel of Dharma, finally took the aspect of passing away, dying, passing into parinirvana. So that, in a nutshell, just as a sort of an introduction, is a little bit about the life of the Buddha, the 12 deeds.
Separate paths. So the Lam Rim contains all of the teachings. The Hinayana spread to different countries like Sri Lanka, Thailand, you know, and Burma, Vietnam, and flourished there. Later on, when the Mahayana flourished, that spread to China, Tibet, Mongolia, and the northern countries, and flourished there. So anyway, the great Atisha, he came to Tibet, so he wrote the first Lam Rim, you know, the graduated path, taking all of Buddha's teachings, but putting it in a very clear, step-by-step, you know, approach. And he called it the three scopes. So in Tibet, this really flourished. So this is what we still practice today. You know, when you see these Lam Rim texts and Lam Rim books, it's all the same way of approaching the spiritual path and the inner development.
Logical likelihood
of suffering lives in the future, given that we have a continuity of consciousness that is literally beginning, assuming, given that we've been within samsara, having ignorance and therefore delusions and therefore being reborn again and again and again, and therefore creating negative karmas endlessly, as well as positive ones. So it's logical, it's just logical. There's a possibility of many suffering rebirths that our mind could take when it leaves this body at the time of death. So Atisha gets us to contemplate the suffering of the lower realms in order to energize and to have a healthy revulsion of being born in this way. This then leads us naturally to the next point, to turn for refuge to Buddha, who is the person who existed 2,500 years ago, who gave us the path, which is the actual refuge, the Dharma itself, the medicine to cure our mind, the method to help ourselves transform ourselves, to avoid suffering in the future. This leads us then to the culmination of the first scope, which is the essence of the practice, which is abiding by the laws of karma. Learning to know what to do and learning to know what to avoid doing. Simply to avoid suffering and to get what we do want, which is happiness. A very practical solution. Because one of the things we're seeing clearly from understanding karma is that we are responsible for our own suffering and we're responsible for our own happiness, literally. In the second scope, we look more deeply, we look more in a more sophisticated way into our minds and start to see how even this life is in the nature of suffering. But it's much more subtle awareness we need to develop. Really is where we learn to be our own therapist. Understand very deeply in the context, for example, one way of looking at this whole scope is in the context that we discussed last week, of the Four Noble Truths. And the essential point of that is the third one, which is Buddha's assertion that we can be free of suffering. This then really prepares us now to practice the second wing, the third scope, which is the work we do in relation to others. The heart of which is the development of compassion, specifically the development of a very focused, highly developed level of great compassion called bodhicitta. There's love and compassion, for example, is two essential characteristics. Love is the wish that others be happy. Compassion is the wish they don't suffer. It takes two different aspects of a person's life. So, you know, if you love a person, you see the person, you would be delighting in their good qualities. If you have compassion for a person, you look at the person and you have sorrow for suffering. You know, you wish they didn't suffer. You have empathy with them. They're suffering. Right now, we have the wrong way of cherishing others. We do it because they're our friends and we want them to love us because we can keep them happy. It's completely got strings attached right now, the way we cherish others. And this is why, too, when we have our compassion now, we do have compassion now. We have compassion that's based on attachment. And so it always drags us down. That's why even if we're in the helping profession, we're being very compassionate. We get exhausted and drained. You know, it drags us down. We have to help people, mentally or physically. We get dragged down by it because we still have attachment to our own needs. So we're talking here of being way beyond attachment. Really extraordinary, to go to extraordinary degrees of genuinely cherishing others with no strings, which is almost inconceivable in our culture. Because in our culture, ego is the reference point. It's the realization of the wisdom of emptiness that uproots finally the instinct of ego, which completes the wisdom wing. And then the work of benefiting others is what culminates, is what completes the active, proactive work of benefiting others, compassion. So it's then that person who finally becomes a Buddha, they've perfected the two wings, completed the two wings, completed the wisdom, completed the compassion.
It's really easy. The teachings say, and I think this is really true, you can't develop the more advanced realizations if you don't have the very basic ones. I mean, if you haven't coped with our own impermanence and death and suffering, it's impossible to really have a true motivation to get out or even to help others because we haven't really allowed ourselves to get in touch with how bad it really is, to give us the energy to develop the qualities to make it as good as it's possible to be. And I think the first 12 or 13 years of my practice, I didn't do it that way. I kind of was a lot more hit and miss and really into, you know, trying these more advanced practices and thought they were really cool. And but I don't think I fundamentally was becoming a better human being. And it's not until I really went back and thought, you know, I'm not getting anywhere as fast as I wanted to go. So maybe I should do it the way they explain it, you know, that you're really supposed to do it. And spend a year on precious human rebirth. And spend a year on death and impermanence until something really moves in my mind. So that's been my experiment the last 3 to 5 years. And from, at least from my personal experience, my internal experience, I think it's really, I'm finally feeling some shifts take place. And the thing that I find really interesting is that as I focus really on the beginning steps, even though I'm focusing most of my attention on the beginning, the other areas actually come more into focus. It's almost like dominoes, a domino effect. Yeah, then it's just a question of not being lazy and stop wasting time and just do the steps. And then maybe become a Buddha. Help some people or something. It'd be great.
Any questions about anything you saw? Yeah. Wait a minute. Microphone.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. So, what are the steps?
What are the steps? That's what this class is about. Yeah. Well, I'll give you a couple of things to think about. I've taught this class several times, and I go one time I'll go off in one direction, another time I'll go off in another direction, but they are the same steps, right? The Lam Rim, the stages to the path to enlightenment. It was mentioned that Lama Atisha, who came to Tibet, he was an Indian guru who came to Tibet back around the 4th century, and he, evidently Buddhism had become kind of degenerate, and so he was the one that took all the teachings and put them in this format that became the Lam Rim, but the text called the Lamp to the Path to Enlightenment. So it was very cool, and so these are the stages to the Path to Enlightenment, and we're going to talk about it in several different ways in this class, but the claim, you know, I'm not going to say it works for everybody, because nothing, you know, Buddhism isn't for everybody, you know, I'm perfectly clear about that. Some people, you know, it's just a natural fit, it feels like coming home. For other people, it's like, you know, I'm out of here, this doesn't work for me. But anyway, the Lam Rim of these, just laid out in such a way that if we do this meditation and this meditation and get the experience of the meditations, okay, these are contemplative meditations, generally speaking, but there are practices later on, the more advanced, where we develop laser-like concentration and then finally wisdom, Okay? So it's all laid out in a nice step-like way. That's called the Lamrim, the stages of steps to the path to enlightenment. So that's, and then she, and then Venerable Rubina and I think Venerable Karen both talked about, they were two of the people that spoke, they talked about the three scopes. Okay? Those are the three scopes of the Lamrim, and we talked a little bit about that in the very beginning, but there are certain meditations that help you get this first scope realization, which is basically the motivation for practicing the first scope is to have your next life be better. Okay? So that's the first scope. And there are certain meditations that you need to do to get there. You know, seeing the preciousness of this life and seeing that we're all going to die. You know, we're all going to die. We don't know when. It could be tonight. You know, the only thing, the only currency that we can spend at the time we're dying is spiritual currency. You know, not 401k, not, you know, all the fun we had, not the great vacations, the great this. The only thing that's going to help us at that moment. So those kind of meditation on refuge. You know, like taking putting a safe, positive direction in our lives. We, in Buddhism, we talk about taking refuge. And there's a whole class on refuge, but we'll discuss that too. So anyway, that's the first scope. And then the second scope has to do with liberation. You know, this determination to be completely free of all suffering, nirvana. You know, just nobody knows. Everybody thinks nirvana is a ban, or the word is thrown around, you know, so... You know, but I don't think, you know, but it means freedom from suffering. This is the Buddhist view. Complete freedom from suffering. Nobody, no other spiritual, no psychological practice that I'm aware of, no other religion posits or claims that it can completely, that it can teach us in this life how to stop our suffering. You know, but this is the claim in nirvana. We can actually achieve nirvana in this life with this body. Is possible to stop all suffering. Okay? And there are meditations that we do. Basically, ethics is a key point, concentration and wisdom. So these are, you know, the practices, you know, and then being aware of all the kinds of suffering that we want to be free of and so forth. So there's certain meditations that we do in this middle scope to achieve complete liberation. And then the third scope is the, what we call the Mahayana. You remember they were talking about the Hinayana. Anybody know what the word Hinayana, anybody heard the word Hinayana before? Anybody offended by that term? Some people are. But anyway, it's the kind of Buddhism, and I'm not putting it down because I have back in the day when I was put loose and fancy free. I love all kinds of Buddhism, so I spent time in Japan studying and practicing a little bit of this Zen stuff, and Thailand and Sri Lanka, time there. I love Thai Buddhism. I love Theravada Buddhism, and that is the motivation in the Theravada Buddhism, which is the Hinayana, is individual liberation. It's what we're talking about, nirvana. The goal is to achieve nirvana, and that's a great goal. Stop our own suffering, you know. And then we don't harm others either, by the way, when we stop our own suffering. So wanting to achieve nirvana is a great goal, and that's the goal of the Theravada or the Hinayana wing. But the Mahayana wing is called full enlightenment. What does that mean? Full enlightenment. And it just, we don't have any way to conceptualize this. But the goal is, I'm going to say it multiple different ways. It's based on great compassion. Not sentimental loving compassion, but great compassion. Not only for ourselves, but universal living beings. Okay? And the goal is to eliminate all of our faults and to develop all of our good qualities, which seems like, well, that sounds great, but I couldn't do it. Right? We usually think, we don't see ourselves as being capable of even nirvana. That seems like so far outside the realm of possibility. But enlightenment, oh, that's too much. But at least we need to begin to open up our mind to the possibility that we have this amazing spiritual potential that's untapped. And the Lam Rim is the method to tap into that spiritual potential. So, I must become enlightened in order to benefit all beings. Right? Based on genuine love and compassion. So, genuine compassion, the wish that beings could be free from suffering, love, the wish that beings could have happiness and its causes. So based on that, not just for some, but for all beings, universal beings, we set as our goal, you might say, our aim is supreme enlightenment. Why? To be happy, we don't have to become enlightened. We could have gotten off, I'd kind of jokingly say, the train, you know, went through Nirvana, the station. If we just wanted to be happy ourselves, we would have gotten off at Nirvana. Because we would have been blissfully happy. Blissfully happy. But if we want to help others, truly help others, the goal of the Mahayana is to help others in every conceivable way. And the only being that can do that is a Buddha. Someone who's developed their qualities, eliminated their fault. Okay? So that's the goal. That's the Mahayana. That's the third scope. Okay? Now, that's one way of presenting it. Now, the other way to present it, and I'm going to try in this class to focus a little bit more on this other way, is called the three principal paths, or the three principal aspects of the path. This book came out 100 years ago. Let's see. It's still, I think we have it in the bookstore, 1999. But this is one of my teachers, Geshe Sonam Rinchen, wrote this book. And he is he's an amazing example and scholar. And the words in this book can totally be trusted to present the three principal aspects of the path. The World of Tibetan Buddhism by His Holiness is another one. There's a whole bunch of books listed here that you can read, and there are readings for this class as well. So it's going to be up to you to get the readings done. But the three principles of the path are kind of cool. They're because everybody can understand these, I think, even maybe a little easier than the three scopes. The first one is called renunciation. Now, that sounds weird, doesn't it? The word renunciation, what does it imply? What do people, when they hear the word renunciation, what do they think? What's it like, the pedestrian conversation about renunciation? Pardon?
Giving something up.
Can you give her the microphone? Yeah. Giving something up.
So, sorry, may I put another question, perhaps not to answer right now, but connected with the first one?
Yeah.
Hold on.
Go ahead. All right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, sorry for that. Yeah, it's because I have this in my mind to answer, but Tantra is a fast track. We need to skip the smooth things and go to the fast track, or if we complete the slow motion and then the fast track doesn't have a meaning because we already go through the slow motion thing.
Yeah.
Just if you could comment something.
Well, I think you said it.
Right.
I mean, it's yeah. So I did, the word Tantra did come up, and Tantra is, you know, everybody wants the fastest, the quickest way to get enlightened, right? I mean, I do. Raise your hand. Yeah, and Tantra sounds like fun. I mean, you know, it looks interesting. All the iconography is very graphic and interesting and all that sort of stuff. But Tantra is really hard, really difficult. demanding, you know, a lot of commitments, a lot of realizations, and you have to have a foundation of the three principal aspects of the path. So that's the door to Tantra. So that's kind of the juicy part of this class, is that if you have an intellectual understanding and even some feeling for the three principles of the path, then you are qualified at least to go into the doorway and learn about and maybe even start practicing Tantra at a baby level, at a very beginning level. So this is, three principles of the path are really important for those who want to get into the speedier, more advanced practices. But as Kendall, the last lady who was talking as a layperson, I mean, I've known her for 30 years, and she, so she spent like 15 or 16 years. She used to go do retreats for 6 months, a year at a time, Hashtag Tantra retreats and stuff like that. And she was just saying, that didn't get me anywhere. I mean, it got her somewhere, but she wasn't getting what she wanted. That's what I heard. And so she went back to the Lam Rim. She went back to the three principles of the path. And she started studying these and taking. She said, let's, you know, death and impermanence, rather than just whizzing through it, let's meditate on that for a year. Wow. 6 years later. So, you know, this is not the fast, by the way, this is not the quick and easy, is it? This is very hard work, changing our mind. And we all know that. We know, for example, tomorrow we're not going to wake up and have a new mind, have a new mindset. It is going to take effort. It's going to, we say in Buddhism, moderate effort over time. That's what it's going to take. Yeah. So, now your comment about renunciation. Yeah, it sounds like you're giving something up. Okay, so let me just define renunciation. It's really about having compassion for yourself. It really is. It's about the determination to be free of what? Of suffering. So it's really important to have some awareness of what your life is really like. Not just what you dream about it, but what is really going on with you? What is really going on with me? What is the future going to look like for us? Can we handle it? Can we handle all the challenges? And we'll go over what those challenges are. It's really going to be interesting. And if our mind is freaking out, it's going to be suffering, isn't it? If those challenges come up and we have tamed our mind and developed our qualities and developed different ways of transforming problems and dealing with difficulties, and we can see things with the eye of wisdom, we don't have to suffer. This is the claim of Buddhism. We don't have to suffer. Or at least, we don't have to suffer as much. I'll go for that. I'll go for that. That'll be a good start. Not as much. So we just practice. That's what we do. We practice, and we let and whatever happens is going to happen. But we do it sincerely. So renunciation is this determination to be free. And it's based on compassion for yourself, right? And it also is based on some realization that, hey, something's not quite right here. There's something to be free of. There's something that we need to be free of. And that's the Sanskrit word is dukkha, or suffering. And it's also based on some conviction, realization, or just a feeling that, hey, I'm not a basket case. I can actually do this. I can actually achieve something meaningful with my mind and with this life. I can free myself from suffering. So I think we have to have some confidence, some self-confidence. Otherwise, renunciation doesn't make any sense. So we have to have some confidence that we, you know, so this determination to be free, and I can do it. Okay? So that's renunciation. Then bodhicitta is what we were talking about a moment ago. It's this whole business of setting, you know, based on, and it's the most powerful motivation for spiritual practice. The most, and without this motivation, by the way, Tantra, instead of a Buddha, you become Darth Vader. And I'm serious. You go the wrong way, to the dark side, because it's all ego stuff, and it doesn't work. Tantra becomes poisonous. So it has to be done with the right motivation and bodhicitta. So renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct emptiness all are necessary. But bodhicitta is this heart of enlightenment where our aim is supreme enlightenment, and why do we want to become enlightened? The only reason we need to get enlightened is so we can help others. That's the only reason. We want to help others. And the only person that can truly help others is someone who's done the work themselves, right? Who's developed their qualities, who's eliminated their faults, who knows the mind of other people, who knows exactly what you want and need. What practice and which teachings are going to work for you? What practice and teachings are going to work for you? What practice and teachings are going to work for you? Because we're all different. So Buddha would be able to give us exactly the right medicine for whatever delusions, whatever diseases we have. So this is the Mahayana, the heart of enlightenment, this altruistic intention to become enlightened, based on love and compassion. And there are different ways of developing it. There are two different streams of contemplations. We'll do one, at least one or two. We did and it kind of touched on a little bit tonight, but we'll talk about how to develop this, because there's systematic ways to develop bodhicitta so that it, we can actually experience a heart opening to others, not just hearing the words, but actually experience it sincerely doing the practices. And then the last point is the correct view of reality. Of emptiness. Did you talk about emptiness?
It came up.
Does anybody want to take a stab at what emptiness means? Yeah, go ahead. I might just have people stand up, and then they'll remember to get the mic.
Do you want me to stand up?
You can.
That things are empty of values from their own side, that things are don't have intrinsic value of their own side, other than what we kind of project onto them with our mind.
Yeah. Yeah. That's nice. Crisp. Everybody got that? Now, how's that going to change your life tomorrow? How's it going to change? How's that going to make a difference?
Well,
when your boss is yelling in your face tomorrow, giving you your pink slip and telling you that you're incompetent?
It makes me realize that I have a choice in how to perceive that, and how I can choose my perception, which shifts my attitude to it, whatever's happening. So even if I'm getting fired or in the most dire circumstances, I can choose how to perceive that.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily negative on its own side. It could be perceived as negative if you choose to perceive it as negative, but you could also perceive it as an opportunity for something positive.
Yeah. Okay. Because it's empty. Because it is empty.
Yes.
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 Okay. Well, that's a great start. Anybody else want to go for it? Give emptiness a stab?
One other thing, you're talking about things not having meaning in and of themselves, but how what we project on them. It makes me also sort of think, well, we project, something onto, say, jewelry or clothing or something, because that sends a message in our culture. A lot of the things that we hold valuable in our lives, materially or spiritually or emotionally, are due to connections. And so to me, emptiness is something like, it's not just the fact that things don't have meaning in and of themselves, but it's also they're meaningless without the connections that they have with everybody else and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so interdependence.
That would have said it better.
It proves that things are empty because they don't exist intrinsically. Everything is in a web of interdependence. So that's that's another way we prove emptiness. So let me use this example. Does anybody know what this is? You ever seen one of these? Yeah? Okay. So I don't know exactly where this is going to end up, by the way, but where I'm talking. But anyway, so I think most people here would say that's a cell phone, right? A mobile phone. Now, if your dog, who's got a dog here? A lot of people have dogs. So you bring your dog, let's say you brought your dog in here to, and he wondered, he was just sitting down here and I put my phone down and he saw that. And what do you think he might do with it? It looked, he'd probably pick it up and start chewing on it. He'd think, oh, this is a, do you think he'd see cell phone? No, he'd see something completely different. Now who's right? Is this a toy? Or is this a cell phone? How can it be both? Now, the dog leaves the room and you leave the room. What is it then? Does it cease to exist? We don't see it anymore. The dog doesn't see it anymore. Yeah. So, you know, these are the kind of questions that we're going to talk about. There is an object, but it's so subtle, and it depends upon our mind labeling it, doesn't it? There's no cell phone that exists independent of our mind labeling it. There's no toy to that dog that exists independent of that dog's mind labeling it. So we are creating our world moment to moment. Now this is what's juicy about this. Who wants to see themselves as being happy? Raise your hand. Yeah, and nirvana and being a Buddha. Who wants to see themselves as suffering? Nobody. Okay. Now, you can't call this cell phone a car. Well, yes, you can. But then you'd be going to, you know, you'd be crazy. We'd say you're crazy because we all know, we all agree this is a cell phone. It functions like a cell phone. So you can't just make stuff up. Okay. But we are forced. You don't have a choice. When you see this, you say cell phone automatically. You don't have a choice in the matter. Why? Because you learned about 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, whenever these things started existing, that these were cell phones. And then from then on, you had to label cell phone. Okay? You can't change that. And so the karma, we're going to call it karma, all this conditioning that is in our mind, all these imprints that had been placed on our mind stream from beginningless time until right now, are forcing us to have an experience of being ourselves, being in this room, being in a Buddhist center, having whatever experience you're having, good, bad, or indifferent. You know, are you happy or are you miserable? You know, our mind creates our reality. And if we want to be happy, guess what? Because things are empty and because our mind is projecting our reality, virtue leads to happiness. So not harming others. That's what we call virtue. Actions that lead to happiness are by nature virtue. And so non-harming. So actions motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, non-ignorance always are going to lead to happiness. And that's what we want. And actions motivated by greed, hatred, ignorance, pride, jealousy, and there are 84,000 delusions. There's a lot of them. But those are some. They always lead to suffering because our mind creates our reality. And so we want to be forced, as one teacher once said, I want to be forced to see myself in paradise. I like that. Because we, our karma is constantly ripening. And the good news is that we've, well, bad news, good news. Bad news is we've created eons of negative karma that is absolutely going to ripen as suffering if we don't do something about it. But we can do something about it. We actually can purify our karma. We can at least decrease the power of it so we don't have to suffer. And we'll talk about that too as the class goes on. So I'd like to stop here for a minute. Excuse me. And I'd like for people to, I'd like for you to pick one person next to you. You know, it could be somebody you came with or somebody else. It doesn't have to be a stranger, but I'd like you to get with somebody else just for about 2 minutes each and say, what is it that at the end of these 6 weeks, what is it that you would like to create for yourself from a spiritual perspective? What is the outcome that you would like to have happen as a consequence of your participation over this next 6 weeks of practice? And by the way, I put an underline on 20 because that'll be a practice day. We'll come a little early and stay a little late so we can cover, we'll do in-depth meditations on at least the three principles to cover, you know, to get the whole picture. But I'd like you to take a couple of minutes, pick a person. Oh, by the way, this person is going to be your buddy for this class. So we used to do this early on, but you can check in with one another. If you have questions, you can exchange phone numbers, blah, blah, blah. And I'd like for everybody here to do some meditation every day, like 10 to 15 minutes a day. I'm not asking for like an hour yet, but you know, 10 to 15 minutes of meditation a day. So everybody do the buddy thing. 2 minutes each way. What do you want to accomplish? What do you want to create for yourself out of your participation over the next 6 weeks? for oneself alone. Control of the class. It's an illusion of control. All right, can you bring those conversations to a close, please? Or everybody raise your hands. Just kidding. Isn't that how we do it with the kids? Get them to raise your hands. Okay. All right. So hopefully you got something useful out of that. So. Let's pass out the text. Yeah. So written on the board, the three scopes and the three principal aspects of the path. Yeah, thank you. And then, this is both of them, isn't it?
That's the
We'll pass that out next week. Just to give people, we'll work on the three scopes this week, okay? You can.
And I have 30 of these, and there's a little over 40 people in here, so a couple people should.
And I think these might be online, so you can
get the mic.
So it's good to, I'm going to try to teach this class based on this text. This is a Lamrim text, by the way. Okay, there are a lot of different Lamrim texts. We're going to do another one called The Foundation of All Good Qualities, which is another Lamrim text. Those of you who are doing Discovering Buddhism and want to get credit for it, you need to memorize one of these texts. And so. We'll pass the other one out next week, I think, just one at a time. And go ahead, Aaron.
So if you want to access this exact prayer online, I added, if you've never accessed the online readings, it's on the overview that Joan has right there. When you go to your online readings PDF, there's right below it, there's going to be these two prayers, links to this prayer and the one we get next week. So if you want to read it at home, it's right there on the website with all your other readings.
All right. So we're going to, let's take a moment and read this together. And, for many of you, this is like brand new territory. You've never read a Buddhist prayer before, but you can think of it, prayers, anytime we read prayers, We're planting seeds, okay? We're planting seeds. You might not make any sense at all, particularly when we get to the part about the wisdom of emptiness. If your head doesn't spin, you might be the only one in the room that's not head's not spinning, because it's cryptic. It's not easy to understand when you read it, but we'll talk about it and try to unravel the meaning of each of these. But one of the key things in Tibetan Buddhism, and it just starts out right off the bat, it says, I bow down to the perfect gurus. And I'm just going to say one or two words, because even there's a whole module in Discovering Buddhism about the importance of the teachers. And these Lam Rim texts are presented in the context of Tantra, because in Tantra, that's when the relationship with the student and teacher become really, really, really important. But it's also important even in the, I mean, everything we've ever learned, really, we learn from teachers, right? We have our parents, we're our first teachers, and so on. So, you know, there's a real emphasis in Buddhism on having respect for and paying homage to the valid teachers. And what is it we'll talk about at some point? What are the qualities of a qualified teacher, which I am not? I just want to point that out. So we'll go ahead and read this together and plant some seeds, and then we'll be close to wrapping it up. I bow down to my perfect gurus, the essential meaning of the victorious one's teachings, the path placed by all the holy victors and their children, the gateway of the fortunate ones desiring liberation. This I shall try to explain as much as I can. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones, you fortunate ones, listen with a calm mind. Without the complete intention definitely to be free from circling, there is no way to pacify attachment seeking pleasurable effects in the ocean of circling. Also, by craving for cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. Freedom endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. By thinking over and over again that actions and their effects are unbetraying, and repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence, attraction to the appearances of future lives is reversed. When, by having trained in that way, there is no arising, even for a second, of attraction to the perfections of cyclic existence, and all day and night the intention seeking liberation arises, then the thought of renunciation has been generated. Even if renunciation has been developed, if it is not possessed by the mind of enlightenment, it does not become the cause of the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment. Therefore, the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. Swept away by the current of four powerful rivers, tied in the tight bonds of karma so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped by the total darkness of ignorance, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings, thinking that all mothers are in such a condition, generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. In short, if like the mother whose cherished son has fallen into a pit of fire and who experiences even 1 second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity, your reflection on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear their suffering for even 1 second, and the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort, then you have realized the supreme precious mind of enlightenment. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you've generated renunciation in the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of circling. Therefore, attempt the method to realize dependent arising. One who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena, of both cyclic existence and the state beyond sorrow, as forever unbetraying, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing to Buddhas. If the appearance of dependent relations, which is unbetraying, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they are seen as separate, then one has still not realized the Buddha's intent. If these two realizations are happening simultaneously without alternation, and for merely seeing dependent relations as completely unbetraying, the definite ascertainment comes that completely destroys away all objects are apprehended as truly existent. At that time, the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. Furthermore, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect, then you are not captivated by wrong notion holding extreme views. In this way, you realize exactly the vital points of the three principal aspects of the path. Resort to seeking solitude, generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish your final goal, my child. Okay, so great. So we've got some work to do. So homework this week, I'd like for you to read through this prayer at least once a day and just work, do mindfulness of the breath. Just do 15 to 20 minutes of mindfulness of the breath. If you have another daily practice, a visualization practice, or even Vipassana, I think that's fine if you want to do mindfulness practice in general. Whatever practice, but I'd like for you to, we're not going to do any contemplative meditation. Just do one of those practices to settle the mind, and then next week we'll go back, we'll get into this a little deeper. The reading that I'd like for you to do are there are three, and they're not very long readings. I'd like for you to do those three readings that are listed somewhere. I had them here. Thank you.
That's
right. Turning the Wheel by Lama Yeshe, Method Wisdom, and the Three Paths Geshe. So there's these don't take that long. And it's a nice foundation for where we want to go from there. So yeah, if you can do those readings, do some practice every day. Next week, I would invite you, now we haven't done this in a long time, but to maybe check in with your buddy once during the week to see how it's going, see if they're doing their practice and if they have any questions. I'm just inviting you to do that as a way to support yourself to do some practice every day, because as you know, Buddhism is, it really takes some effort over time, but you can do it. So you just have to put a little effort in. You have to carve out a little time. Usually in the morning is best, before the kids get up and before, you know, the noise of the day and the mind gets cranked up. Try to set up a quiet place in your house, cushion, sit down and do the readings and do the practice. You can do it in a chair too. It doesn't have to be a cushion. So anyway, you want to say something? Helps.
I have a question.
Okay.
On our list is a list of books that may be assigned in this class.
Right.
Are there any that you particularly know that we should be preparing to buy? Or we don't have, multiple copies of any of those in the bookstore right now.
I would prefer, the three principal aspects of the path. Now this is an old version of it, but there's a new. It was put out by Snow Lion. I would prefer that people, if they'd read one book, this would be the one I'd like for them to read. But if you can read other ones, there are other books that are mentioned here in the list. But if you can do all the readings, great. But this one is the juiciest one. All right, now, at the end, so anytime we do something here, we try to do it. In the beginning, we want to set our motivation to be positive, right? Bodhicitta motivation. At the end, we want to dedicate it. So dedication is kind of like, I'd like to believe that something positive has been generated, that, we've thought about some things, maybe new concepts, planted some positive seeds in our mind, these seeds that we've, if we've had the right motivation, these seeds will definitely ripen in future happiness. So we want to dedicate the positive seeds of our being together tonight, not only for our own happiness, but for the happiness of all beings. So just for a moment, just think about that, that we're dedicating the merit, we call it dedicating the merit to the benefit of all living beings. Okay, so we're done. And if anyone has any burning questions, I'll stick around. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Oh, last but not least, question. I would like to know who is really committed to being here for 6 weeks. So, wait a minute. I'm going to do that. If you're going to be here 6 weeks, stand up. Not going to miss a class. It's okay if you don't stand up. Okay. Great. Now, sit down. Now, those who are not going to be here, no, I'm just kidding. Okay, we're all done. Thank you.